Hi, I'm Meredith.
And I'm Katie.
And you're listening to I'm Not Scared, You're Scared,
a horror movie podcast.
If you are a fan of the show, please like and follow us on iTunes and Spotify and review us. It'll help spread the word.
Also, you can follow us on Instagram at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared, or email us at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared at gmail.com.
Thanks for joining us. We're here to talk about the Salem's Lot miniseries released in the 1900s.
Oh, so long ago.
Yeah. 1979. And
lots of other related.
It's in celebration of one of our favorite creators of all time.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited because I did most of what I could do.
You did a ton of preparation considering it's, you know, my recap today. Meredith is uber prepared.
And it's during this beginning of the school year.
Right.
So I've been very tired as well. But somehow just like power through. I'm like, I gotta do this. Like, I don't know.
Let me sip
my Diet Cokes and make it happen.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have not seen you in a long time.
It has been longer than you were used to.
Yeah. So what is new?
Well, as I'm guessing is true for you as well, most of what's new is school. We just finished up our, I think, third full week of instruction for the year. I am happy to report that things are going really well. Like, I feel like, and this is something that you could relate to, and because in your time at the school, your current school location, like, you've had to move grade levels and move classrooms.
Yeah.
And the real like beauty and satisfaction of going back to school in the same classroom, teaching the same content at the same grade level as you did the previous year.
Like, what a concept.
I know, not starting from scratch,
yes.
You know, having materials already developed, having plans already in place, having done things before so that you know what you can do to refine them, but also not needing to change them if you don't feel like it. And so, you know, the year's gone pretty smoothly. I got a good group of kids this year. They were, you know, squirrely and chatty. And that's, I think, a product. I really enjoy being at my sixth grade level because all the kids coming into my homeroom, I taught last year for literature in fifth grade. So I already know their names. I know their personalities. I know they're, you know, so much about them already. I've spent a year with them. The flip side of that is they're already comfortable with me and comfortable with my classroom environment. And so they don't have that like first week of school, like, oh, this is a new adult that I have to get a feel for and get a read on. I better be on my best behavior. Like, they come in just ready to party.
Yeah. No, what do you call it? It's grace period.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I have had to, you know, get my thinking cap on and come up with a couple of new strategies to deal with some of the transitions that weren't going smoothly in our day. But they responded really quickly to it. And one of the things I struggled with a lot last year was my group. Like, I have all of these like routines that I figured out, like, this is truly the best and fastest way to do this. Mm-hmm. And you have to trust me and you have to do it the way I'm telling you to do it. And last year, it took half the school year for like most of the class to get on board with those things, and some of them never did. Mm-hmm. And this group, like, out the gate was just like, oh, all right, okay, that's how we do it, all right, we'll do it, like, without, you know, so much of a battle. Mm-hmm. So it's actually it's been good. And so I've been, you know, I have my new partner teacher this year, and she's like, I warned her about a lot of the chaotic things about our school. And so, you know, she keeps saying, she's like, you told me this is how it was. But it's still, I mean, I think that she's still a little like,
kind of. It's one thing to be told, another thing to live it.
Yeah. So she's still a little dazed kind of on a daily basis of like, wait, what the fuck now? And what else?
Yeah.
And what about this? Already having to deal with difficult parents, already, you know, recognizing that planning is a challenge. Plus, she's, you know, we adopted a new science curriculum starting this year. And so it's not even like there's material materials there from previous teachers that she could use. Like, it's brand new to everybody at the school, not just her. So she's also learning to navigate a new curriculum in her mm-hmm. subject area while adjusting to an entirely new school site.
Yeah, that's challenging.
Yeah. So she, you know, she's there long hours, but she has a really positive attitude. I'm hoping that she sticks around longer than any of the other teachers yeah. in my time there have.
Yeah, because Katie and I are at different, she's in the city, I am in a little suburb yeah. of San Francisco area, like outside another mm-hmm. city, but it's small. So our district is very tiny compared to the Archdiocese, but mm-hmm. although the Archdiocese is getting smaller, but yeah. she was in my school site for like a few days. She mm-hmm. did a job share with somebody, so right. I barely knew her. Mm-hmm. But it was like, she did comment that it was closer to home, like the where she's teaching yeah. now, I think.
Oh yeah, no, she lives a few blocks from school, like I do.
Yeah, so I yeah. mean, she's like, I'm not gonna miss the driving down the coast. Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful, but sometimes you like, you just gotta get to work.
Yeah,
I'm like, exactly. I get it. So yeah. she seemed nice, but really, you know, like she had a lot of buy-in from what I could tell for mm-hmm. like, you know, enjoying the kids and all yeah. that stuff. So
but there's a little bit of a culture shock that comes from she grew up Catholic, but she's never taught in a Catholic school. Mm-hmm. So teaching religion, taking 31 students to mass and making them behave, like all of that's a joyful new experience for her. And then also, you know, she worked for the county. And so she was providing education services for kids that were not from the most privileged of backgrounds, some of them from, you know, in difficult situations. I believe some of them like in group homes or foster situations. And so, you know, going from that to like the kids at our school we're not at one of the richy rich Catholic schools in the city, but they're entitled. Like these little shits are entitled. And some of their parents are as well.
Do you know who my father is?
Right? So.
No, really, do you? I don't know.
And so that's a little bit where like she's seeing these kids get resources and support and grace that, you know, the kids that she's worked with in the past absolutely deserve and probably never had access to.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just there adjustment everywhere you look.
Sure. Yeah.
But I think she's handling it really well.
Yeah. I mean, our good friend Rachel, she does like IT other things in mm-hmm. a very, very wealthy kind of district in South Bay. Mm-hmm. And she's had kids like, I want a new laptop. And she's like, well, this one works fine. And then like 2 days later, iced tea was spilt on it
yeah.
to
Oops.
Get something. Oh, that happened accidentally. And she's yeah, like, oh, my
Stanley fell over.
She's like, no. Oh, my God. And, you know, it's like, I want the newest Mac. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, I don't even have words for that.
It's really hard.
That's insanity to yeah. me. And that's like a student, not like a teacher. It's right. like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So, well, hopefully it'll work out and she'll be in for a while until she's done teaching and
yeah.
wants to move on.
Yeah, I think everybody, you know, I think in teaching you're probably hoping that each position, like, that's where you're going to stick until yeah. you're done. Like, nobody wants to plan on changing sites, changing roles or yeah. whatever. Because it's so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, maybe she will. All I know is that, because I know I'm not planning on being at this school I'm not planning on teaching forever. And I really would like when I leave to have the other sixth grade teacher be somebody who is already really established at the school.
Like solid.
So that, yeah. So mm-hmm. that whoever comes in to take my role will have that person as their, you know, mentor.
Yeah,
you know, to get sure. established.
Yeah. So this became a teaching podcast.
Yep. Welcome to our teaching
Join
podcast.
Us.
Now Meredith
Tips
is going to tell
tricks.
Us what's new with her in her world of teaching.
I have an interesting crop of first graders. And it's not just me. My partner teacher also mm-hmm. feels the
well,
same way.
These are COVID babies.
Yeah. We're just dealing with a class that there was no grace period. Mm-hmm. There's no honeymoon period. It was like wild and crazy.
Walk in and start setting fires.
From the instant they were in my class. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh my gosh. So I had my work cut out for me. And I was so tired the first few weeks of school. I told Victor, I was like, I'm sure I have long COVID. That must be it. And he's mm-hmm. like, babe, you're like this every year. I'm
yeah.
like, no. Like my eyes feel salty. Like when I close them,
yeah.
I was just like,
they're scratchy.
Yeah. I was like, just like I felt like I was hit by a truck, honestly, just so exhausted and tired.
Same. Yeah.
So we'll see. That's TBD. I have to get these kids figured. They just felt like new kindergartners, not first students who went through kindergarten and are ready for first grade. Like, it's very different animal than last year or the year before. And so we'll see. I just have to keep repeating myself ad nauseum, and that just gets exhausting.
Yeah. And they don't grow out of that. Why don't they grow out of that?
No, they just ask me. I don't know. I'll have them say something. This goes in our yellow folder when we're done. Everyone say with me, it goes in our yellow folder. And I ask a student, where does it go? Yellow folder. Okay. 5 minutes later, where does this go?
Like, you little son of a bitch.
ask a friend. Then they ask their friend and they're like, I don't know. And I'm like,
then you just
I'm literally
out.
Holding a little picture of a yellow folder.
Yeah.
And I'm like pointing at it and smiling. Here. So it's just training them.
Yeah.
It's like same system, same routine. And it's like, it gets so exhausting, but it's like worth it. You know, just the same thing. Reinforcement, same thing.
I feel like it shows you what you accomplish with them in the course of a year, because I think one of the reasons it's hard, like, and when you are going back to the same grade level, is that you're going from end of year first graders back to beginning of year first graders.
And
you do forget that
crazy.
like, oh, this was the beginning of last year was too.
Why would you take your shoe off and put it in the sink? Why is that in there now?
Yeah.
There's something on it? Got it. Yeah. Okay. How about we not do that?
Yeah. And so
put your shirt back on. Why is your shirt off? You're hot? Well, roll your sleeves up.
Yeah. Well, this isn't one of the options to deal with that problem at school.
I'm hot.
Yeah. Okay.
My tongue hurts. Can I get a Band-Aid? No.
Not for your tongue. That's not how Band-Aids work.
Laughing. I'm like, oh my gosh.
when I have, like, you go to the beginning of the year and I have fifth graders and sixth graders. And then I realize, like, the fifth graders just seem so, so young, right?
Because they're
fourth
little
graders.
Little babies.
You know, and they're actually a little bit before beginning of year fourth graders, because they lost so much over the summer, you know? Yeah. And so I think it's a testament. Like, you should look at it as a testament to how much you help them develop throughout the course of the year, because then when you get a new crop that haven't had that year under their belt yet, you see how really different they were.
Yeah.
You know, obviously one group is different from the next, but across the board, I bet you it's more a result of your last memory of teaching was end of year first graders.
Who are just like, oh, he's not doing that correctly.
Yeah.
and it was like one of my wild boys. It would be like, oh, he did not push his chair in.
Yeah.
Or he didn't put his folder back where it's supposed to go.
I saw that he was putting it in his red folder instead of his yellow folder. So I told him, you know.
Yeah. And you're like, oh, my God, I love you. Yeah. And then also, I don't know if I talked about this last time we recorded. I doubt it, because I went to see Weapons with my daughter.
Yeah.
And I don't
You invited me and I declined.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be on streaming on the 9th. Probably you'll have to, it's probably a fee of some kind, like streaming fee, but it'll be digital. You don't have to go to the theater, but it was really good. It was fun. Yeah. So anyone who hasn't seen it, it was really funny and scary and, you know,
inventive,
crazy. Yeah. And one of the teachers at my school was like, hey, so you have a podcast? Like, I don't know where he heard it from. I was like, yeah. And he's like, I just saw Weapons. I'm not a huge horror fan, but I really liked it. But there was one thing that had me really having a hard time suspending disbelief. And I was like, what? And he's like, her 18 student class size.
Right.
And I was like, oh, me too. And he's like, and she owned a house. I was like, I know.
Where is this woman living?
And he's like, she bought not one, but two handles of booze. And I was like, I don't know. I agree completely, though.
Yeah.
I thought it was funny because that was my hang up.
Right.
You know how I have hang ups.
Yeah.
I didn't have time to explain to him my weird.
Yeah, well, but clearly this wasn't like a unique weird hang-up of yours. This would be something that would be glaring to anybody in education.
Yeah. So he went and sat and he's like, psh, what? He's like, there's another third grade.
Bullshit.
Yeah, he's like, there are other third grade classes and their caps were 18. What is happening? Anyway, so that's it. Anyone who hasn't seen it, please, you'll enjoy it, I think. including Katie. You got to watch it too.
Yes, I definitely will.
So let's get down. Let's move away from our teaching podcast and move into the horror. The OG Salem's Lot.
Okay, so Meredith mentioned that today's episode is gonna be the first of two in tribute to our creator, the Lord and Savior,
Stephen King.
And I hijacked September this year because Stephen King's birthday is actually September 21st. He's born in 1947, so he's almost 80.
Deke asked me, he goes, "Mom, is Stephen King is he dead or is he alive?" And I was like, "Shut your mouth.
You shut your mouth."
I was like, "He's going to live to be 100.
Yeah, and he's still going to be writing. Yes. So we've already done quite a few of films based on his books in our previous episodes. I made a list. Our first ever episode, which I hope nobody ever goes back and listens to.
No one needs to listen to that.
It's so bad. But it was about Carrie, his first published novel and the first to be made into a film.
We hadn't figured out our rhythm.
We had not. We were over Zoom because it was COVID. Just pretend
things
it never happened.
Messed up.
Yeah. But we've also done The Shining. We did the summer when our theme was secluded settings. We did Children of the Corn, Misery, and Gerald's Game. Mm-hmm. We've also done Pet Sematary, and we did It, both the original and the remakes.
Yeah.
So we've already knocked out, I would say, most of the really heavy hitters of horror movies based on Stephen King's work.
Right.
But the amazing thing about it, and I actually went in and made, you know, a very nerdy Google sheet. But so between 1974, which is the year he published Carrie, his first novel, and when he published If It Bleeds, which was a compilation of short stories in 2020. So in that window of time, he published 57 books.
What a loser.
Right? one of the most, one of the most nauseating terms used to describe him is prolific. And there are people, like, I've had a couple people ask me, and I'll never forget the first time someone mentioned this, they're like, "Do you think he actually, like, writes all his own stuff, or does he have, like, a bunch of ghostwriters?" I was like, "You shut your fucking mouth.
Look, like, at that face. He's crazed.
Yeah.
But of course he's writing also, all these different..."
You can tell that that's someone that hasn't read his work because his voice is so...
It screams
so
the same.
Unique.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would know. It's not like Babysitter's Club. No. Like, he has such an iconic, like, recognizable, you know, and if you're a big fan of him, like, his voice resonates with you. Mm-hmm. It's like a friend telling you a story.
Yes. And all those, like, little asides he does, different things. You're like, "Oh, that's him."
Yeah, that's 100%
him. There's, like, hallmarks of his work.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, and of the 57 books that he published between 1974 and 2020, 42 have been made into films. Mm-hmm. 40 fucking two.
Some great, some
not so great.
Not so great.
And that includes, so, like, obviously, you know, short story collections, there might be like 15 stories in a book and one or two, or, you know, I don't think there's been any that have had more than two or three made into films, but the short story. And that's happening, I think, more and more. Oh my God, I just watched The Monkey.
I haven't watched it.
It's so terrible.
Oh, really?
It, like, not even enjoyable, terrible. It was so disappointing.
That's a bummer.
Yeah. And it was like, it
looked,
was kind
the trailer
of a,
looked fun.
Yeah. But it ended up kind of being a weird kind of Final Destination ripoff.
Oh, what?
Yeah.
That's annoying.
So, yeah, maybe have Charlotte watch it and see if she likes it.
Charlotte, watch this trash. I don't know.
Yeah. So I think that's probably the most recent Stephen King. Like, Boogeyman was shortly before that. Those were both based on short stories.
Yeah.
I think because most of his full novels have already been co-opted.
Or A Long Walk? Is it A Long Walk that's coming out?
A Long Walk. Yeah, that's coming out soon. And that was actually one he published under Richard Bachman. Mm. The four novellas that he published as Richard Bachman early in his career when he was writing under a pseudonym.
I think it's gotten good feedback.
Yeah.
So hopefully that'll be.
I've seen places that are doing screenings where you're on a treadmill while you watch it.
Oh, that's funny. You're like, "I want to feel the burn."
Yep. Okay. And so, you know, that's just a little bit of, like, context for, you know, his representation and why he's such a big deal for, you know, horror movie fans, horror literature fans.
Or even drama, too, though.
Yeah.
Because it's, like, sometimes it's Shawshank, sometimes it's right. outside of that
Stand By Me. Yeah.
Sometimes it's like, hey, want to see the yeah. body? We're like, oh, shit, yeah. yes.
Bring it I wanna, on. I also want to see Kiefer Sutherland. This. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to see this transpire and yeah. see what happens. But he just writes people.
Yeah.
Like he's, it's amazing. And then something fucked up happens and it's like otherworldly and people are reacting to it. Yeah. So it's,
well, and I think know. That yeah. that,
he's like a psychologist in a way.
yeah. And he, like you mentioned, like some, and when he was first publishing, like, I think the idea behind, having the pseudonym of Richard Bachman is those stories were supposed to be not so much horror, mm-hmm. maybe more thriller, not yeah. supernatural, not fantastical. But, you know, he obviously stopped publishing under that pseudonym pretty early on. And as he's continued to write, like so much of his work, it's like you might even say it's like 50-50 supernatural versus just terrifying stuff that, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't need ghosts or demons or vampires in this case.
It's just people
it can just
being
be life.
People.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so one of the other things, I am going to get into the recap eventually, I promise, that I admire about him so much is that he does not, he very rarely reuses content. His ideas like are, it's not like, you know, Dean Koontz or somebody or like Tom Clancy where it's like it's the CIA. It's always the CIA or it's this character or whatever. Like he casts such a wide net and you don't see him going back to old tropes and just, you know, dusting them off and using them again, which he certainly could after, you know, what, 50 years of writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so Vampires, Salem's Lot is the only like feature novel that is entirely about vampires. Mm-hmm. He did, and actually I just was reading it this morning, in his short story collection that was his third published book, Night Shift, included a very short story called One for the Road that was kind of a coda to Salem's Lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like some events in the area a few years after the events of the book.
Okay.
And then there are two other short stories from his collection of called Nightmares and Dreamscapes called Popsy and The Night Flyer. And The Night Flyer has also been made into a film. But, you know, those are just, you know, peppered. And then like there's kind of like vampire-ish characters in the Dark Tower series or whatever. But it's not like he's written three books about vampires.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of like he... And he was starting out too. It's like, well, let's check that box. Okay, mm-hmm. that box is checked. We've done vampires.
Yeah.
And so after, you know, my recap, we can discuss, you know, because everybody or fans of the podcast know I'm not a vampire fan.
No, not at all.
So
I'm like, just give it a chance. It's got vampires. She's like, ugh,
and then you take me to Sea Centers with me not knowing.
And then
it's
you
about,
liked it.
I did love it. So. Okay. So, to note, just a couple recognizable performers in the 1979 TV miniseries Salem's Lot is James Mason, who is like a prolific actor in and of himself. He was very famous for his role in Lolita, and mm-hmm. he was also in North by Northwest, the Hitchcock film that Cary Grant made.
Okay.
One of Cary Grant's Hitchcock films. And he plays Straker. The familiar, the yeah. vampire's familiar. And then, of course, Bonnie Bedelia, a very young, fresh-faced Bonnie Bedelia, who I've probably known her name longer than almost any other actress in my life because Die Hard has been a favorite of mine since I was a little kid.
Sure, yeah.
But she's also, she also appeared in another film adaptation of a Stephen King book, Needful Things, that came out in 93. So she's done multiple Stephen King projects, but that was, you know, obviously much later.
She also plays the matriarch in Parenthood, the show.
Oh, okay.
She's, plays the grandparent, the yeah. mom. But yeah, it's a good show.
Why yeah. and then it was directed by Toby Hooper.
Which is wild. I'm like,
which
really?
Which is kind of crazy.
Okay.
And when I was reading, a little bit of background. Originally, this was supposed to be a feature film, not a TV miniseries, and they had tapped George Romero for it.
Oh, okay.
But then when, I guess, a couple of other feature vampire films had come out and they were worried about competing with it, and so they decided to make it a TV miniseries instead, and Romero was like, meh, he didn't want to be constrained by the limits of what you could put on network television at the time.
He likes to have, like, a little...
Yeah.
Some guts showing, yeah. if he can.
Yeah. And so...
But Toby Hooper doesn't.
Yeah. He's post Texas Chainsaw, they were like, you know who we should put on the job? Toby Hooper.
Well, Toby Hooper was, like, always fun. He liked to allude to things. He never showed things. So he's it sounds like he was perfect for it.
Yeah. And that is definitely how this one read. And so I also, so I should note when it first aired, it was 3 hours, basically. It was 2 90-minute installments a week apart as a miniseries. The version that I recapped that we have access to now is a shortened version of that. I don't know if you really can see the full, not that you'd want to, the 3 hour one. But it's like 112 or 120 minutes, I think, depending on where you're watching it, what's available now. And so that's, you know, there may be scenes that were in the original TV miniseries that aren't in my recap because I don't have access to them.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
What are you going to do?
It's it's a long enough recap as it is. So. All right. So we begin in a church in Guatemala where a boy and a man kneel in prayer. They fill vials with holy water. And when one vial begins to glow blue, the man says, "They found us again." And the boy answers, "We have to go further." And then the scene fades out. We get vintage title card that was actually inspired by the title card of West Side Story, evidently.
Okay.
And the opening credits inspired by the opening credits of The Birds. Which I'm like, eh,
okay.
All right.
Okay.
Of Psycho, not Psycho. The birds. Psycho. But the credits roll over an image of a large house under a full moon, and then day slowly arrives. A Jeep rolls down the road, as a title tells us, Salem's Lot, Maine, 2 years earlier. The same man that we saw in the opening, who is Ben Mears, parks and emerges from the Jeep and stares up at the large house that was under the credits. He watches as a well-dressed older man, Richard Straker, exits the rundown house, gets into a big fancy car, and drives away. Ben drives back into town, and we see the boy from the opening scene standing on a street corner. Inside an antique shop, Straker unpacks curios from crates, and then through a window with a watch for grand opening sign, he watches Ben enter a real estate office across the street. There, Ben asks Mr. Crockett, who's played by Fred Willard, fucking love Fred Willard. R.I.P.
I love him, too. He's so funny.
Wonderful.
I loved him in Modern Family is Frank's, no, not Phil, Phil's dad.
Yeah.
Frank. I'm like, Frank, though, that's wrong.
Okay, so he plays Mr. Crockett, the real estate guy, and Ben asks him about a place to rent for about 6 months. Ben specifically asks about the Marsden house, but Crockett says that it's sold, and then he recommends Eva Miller's boarding house. Ben declines the directions to Eva Miller's, and Crockett comments, "You remember." So we're like, oh, so not so new in town. After Ben leaves, Crockett mentions the Marsden house was vacant for over 20 years to his assistant, Bonnie, and he makes the comment while groping said assistant. So we're like, the 70s.
She's just doing what she's told.
Exactly. She is a bosomy assistant, and she will be groped when it is called for. next, Crockett visits his Main Street neighbor, Barlow and Straker, Fine Antiques, and expresses to Straker how eager their sleepy town is to meet Straker's partner, Barlow, who is set to arrive in town soon. Now, Ben settles into the boarding house room that he's rented, and we learn that he's a writer. Next, we're in an idyllic spot in the woods where Ben is walking and he finds Susan Norton, who is Bonnie Bedelia's character, sketching and reading. And what is she reading? It's Ben's book. Aw, little meet cute.
Little meet cute, yeah.
So they flirt. He asks her to dinner. She accepts the invitation after confirming that he is a widower with no children. So he asks her out and she's like, okay, well, first of all, are you married?
Yeah, and he's I'm not doing any of that crap.
Yep, I'm not some piece of shit.
And he's like, don't worry, I killed my wife.
Yep.
Wait, what? Wait, I'm sorry. I apologize.
That night, Ben is back to kind of stalking the Marsden house, and he is startled standing in the dark road by Straker, who merely says, good evening, and then walks past him heading into the house.
Good evening.
Good evening. And then he walks off into the
fog.
See
you later.
Swirling fog. And Ben stands there with, you know, intense feelings on his face.
Me watching this, I was like,
yes. Yeah. Like the note that I made is I feel like there's so many scenes where next to nothing happens. And I feel like they thought they were building suspense or
someone's
mood.
Like,
and it really, it didn't.
Across the street.
It didn't like, super build the mood.
I was like, uh-huh.
Okay.
And?
That was necessary minute and a half of the movie.
Okay.
What in God's like, name did they cut out?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. What did they not show us?
Yeah. Okay. So back in town, Crockett closes the real estate office and he confirms his adulterous plans with Bonnie for the next night. And then Constable Gillespie hassles the town drunk Weasel. Weasel is actually another actor. It's Alicia Cook Jr. You could also call him prolific. He was in The Maltese Falcon, Big Sleep. He was in Shane. He was in Rosemary's Baby. Just a very, very strong, oft-used character actor.
Now I have to look. Weasel.
Yeah, this is much late, like toward the end of his career.
Okay.
But anyway, so the constable asks Weasel to keep an eye on Ben. He's like, okay. Hey, drunkard, while you sit on the sidewalk and drink, keep an eye on this new guy.
I recognize that face. Yeah for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes. He is definitely like, as soon as you see his face and hear him talking, you're like, yeah, no, I know that dude.
Yeah.
Over in the cemetery, a guy named Mike, keeps watch with his fierce dog, his fierce Doberman. Mm-hmm. And then, also in a living room across town, Cully Sawyer is pounding beers. He's played by George Zunza, who was, I love him. He was in Basic Instinct, which is a guilty pleasure, favorite of mine.
pleasure.
But, he was also in Deer Hunter.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. Holy shit. main character in Deer Hunter, not a little side piece. Mm-hmm. That was weird. Anyway, so he's Cully Sawyer. Yeah. He is Bonnie, the bosomy assistant's husband.
Okay? Oh, yes.
So
yes,
now
yes.
We're like, we're getting little, this is just small town bullshit, right? Like this is, it's Bonnie and her husband. And we already heard her make plans to meet up with her boss while her husband is off on a job and blah, blah, blah. So
she's like, we're going to smooch. We're gonna do some smooches.
Smooches. Some big time smooches. And Bonnie arrives home from work. So it's just kind of like this, the evening, the day is wrapping up in Salem's lot and here's everybody doing their evening business.
How do people have affairs when it's like everyone has literally nothing to do?
Yeah.
Except for look outside their window with binoculars
and see you walking
and
down the street
each other.
And wonder where you're going and then watch you walk into someone's house.
Yeah. It's like just a game of telephone and everyone's like, do you know who I just saw? It's like no one's secrets. Yeah. No. Like you have to go live in a city to be like.
Well, and exactly. Like, you know, we both.
Like anonymity.
you know, having reread the book for this episode, like the Mabel Wirtz character.
Yeah.
They didn't put that. In any her character in any of
the town crier,
but she was, you know, like the old overweight lady in the window with her binoculars. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so like how would you get away with anything? And then we find out, oh, you don't. That's what it is. Anyway, yeah, so Ben and Susan are wrapping up their dinner date, which we see tragically was with her parents. It was not, because again, small town, like I you know, there's a diner and a soda fountain when you go out to dinner. That's, you know,
that's the place you go.
Yep. So her dad, who is Dr. Norton, mentions that Weasel used to be married to Miss Miller, Eva Miller, the proprietress of the boarding house. And we cut to Weasel snooping around in Ben's room at the boarding house because the constable has directed him to keep an eye on Ben. And
we don't like outsiders.
Keep an eye on him, will you, Weasel?
I've been listening to nothing but like Maine accents for like days. Like the because I watched the Rob Lowe remake, and then the original one, and then I've been listening to the narrator do like, "Hey, I don't even know
where are you going tonight?
Where are you going, Weasel?" sorry, I just had to it just burst out of me.
Yeah. Okay. And so in Ben's room, Weasel finds writing that is talking about an evil house because we know Ben's a novelist. And so now we're like, okay, this is what he's writing about.
Yes.
After the dinner party at Susan's is over, Ben and Susan go for a drive and they swap personal stories. They end up at the lake. They continue their date on the banks of the lake and do some smooching, some very
more
vanilla
smooches.
Vanilla smooching. The next day, Crockett is summoned by Straker. So Crockett being the real estate guy, you know, he's the one that sold the house to Straker and, you know, rented him the space to open the antique shop. And so now Straker is asking him to have two movers go to the docks in Boston to pick up a valuable crate, which he says will hold a large sideboard, and to take it up to the Marsden house and leave it in the cellar. Straker also instructs Crockett to bring 4 padlocks and lock up every entry point to the house when they leave.
Mm-hmm. That's not suspicious at all.
No, totally normal. Next, Ben visits the high school where we meet Mark Petrie, who's a student rehearsing a play. He is the boy from the beginning. And Ben reunites with his old teacher, Mr. Burke, who is directing the play. Now we jump to the cemetery where Cully Sawyer, Bonnie's long-suffering husband, recruits Mike, the cemetery worker guy, to find a partner for the moving job that night, saying that he, Cully, has other plans. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he's not going to use his moving truck to make the trip up to Boston. He wants Mike and someone else to do it because he's got something else that he's going to attend to.
Boy, does he ever.
Boy, does he. He attends to it big time. Back at the high school, Ben catches up with Susan, who we realize is an art teacher at the school, but her ex, Ned Tebbets, is there and acts like a jackass, as exes in small towns, I imagine, are wont to do. Mm-hmm. Ned tears off in his car, and Ben walks Susan home. Now we're back at the Sawyer house. Bonnie is kissing Cully goodbye for the night, thinking that he's leaving on this moving job. And Cully had come to the real estate office to say goodbye to her. And Cully teases Crockett about her. We say a little too much teasing. And then outside, Cully tells the constable, because of course he's just there, because everybody's just always around, that he's heading to Portland for a pickup. So Cully's got this story, like, Bonnie thinks he's going, it wasn't Boston, Portland. Bonnie thinks he's going to Portland. He's telling the constable he's going to Portland. He's off with his moving truck. Mm-hmm. it's a ruse.
It's like when you clomp your heels, you're like, I'm leaving, clomp, 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 clomp.
And you try to make your voice like fade out. It's like, I'll see you.
Goodbye.
So Mike chains up his dog at the cemetery before he and Ned are met by Cully. Cully sends Mike and Ned off in his moving truck for the pickup job, and Cully strolls away with his 6-pack. As Mike and Ned drive away, we see that they are both well aware of Boom Boom Bonnie's antics Crockett.
I'm like, oh.
Yeah. So this is like for Bonnie. Like just these two random bros, like unmarried men that happen to live in the town, know that she's boning her boss. Yeah. Right? Like that's this small town setting.
Everyone knows.
Everybody knows. Mm-hmm. There are no secrets. Next, Ben runs into Mr. Burke at a bar, and then we cut back to Cully lingering near the cemetery with his beers, and he hears Mike's dog go from barking nonstop to silent, and then the camera pans away from Cully to show us the dog's dead body among the headstones. Mm-hmm. So, trigger warning to anybody who doesn't like cruelty to animals in films.
I mean, to be fair, it was just like looked literally like a little stuffed dog,
right? Yeah,
with some blood poured on it.
Yeah. Okay. So at the dock in Portland, Mike and Ned load a giant crate that Ned remarks is very cold. And on the drive back, they also note that the truck cab feels colder than it should. When they see the crate move on its own in the back of the truck, Ned wants to stop and open it, but Mike is understandably reluctant. He's like, how about we not? How about we just, you know, get rid of it as soon as possible?
Finish the job, take our money, and go.
Exactly. That's the wise move. Now we cut to Cully lurking outside his own house while Bonnie gets ready for Crockett's visit. Now we are at dinner. Ben and Mr. Burke are eating dinner together, and they are discussing the Marsden house. And Ben tells the story of going to the quote haunted house on a dare once as a child, where he thought he saw the hanged corpse of Hubie Marsden, who was the owner of the house.
Yeah, he's like, I could have sworn.
Yeah.
I saw his like puffed up, bloated, dead face looking right at me.
Yeah. Which like the Hubie Marsden had committed suicide in the house like years and years and years before that. And Ben was just, you know, now it was just
in the 40s or something.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. He was supposed to be like a bootlegger or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, and so when Ben was a child, it was just the empty, spooky house up on the hill, and his friends dared him to go inside, and he did, and he swears that he saw Hubie's body hanging there. And Ben presents the theory to Matt that the house is inherently evil and therefore attracts evil men. Mm-hmm. Enter Barlow.
Mr. Barlow.
Mr. Barlow. So After rehearsing for the play, the school play, with Mark at his house, the Glick boys, Danny and Ralphie, are heading home from Mark's house on foot, and they take an ill-advised shortcut through the woods. Just as the two brothers are separated, a wind kicks up and a dark shadow looms up at Ralphie. Meanwhile, Mark and Ned are arriving at the Marsden house, and they get the crate into the cellar. Ned almost goes through with opening the crate, but then the men hear doors creaking inside the house and get spooked and decide to hit the road. And they are in too much of a fright to complete the task of padlocking all the exits like they were told to. Next, Cully is still outside his own house, watching from his hiding spot as Crockett arrives. And then Cully heads over to the house with a beer in one hand and a shotgun in the other. Mm-hmm. Good old country justice. Meanwhile, an injured Danny Glick finally stumbles arriving home without his brother. So we're like, uh-oh, Ralphie didn't make it out of the woods. And next, Straker arrives at the Marsden house, and he's troubled that the locks are not in place. He gave very clear instructions on what was to be done with the locks, and they're not there. He gets a parcel wrapped in black plastic from his trunk and carries it to the cellar, where we see that the crate is in shards everywhere. He lays the parcel on a table and unwraps it. It's an unconscious Ralphie Glick. Straker leaves the cellar and turns out the lights. You're like, oh, this isn't looking good for Ralphie, folks. Mm-hmm. Sorry about that. Now we're back at the
sacrifice.
It's necessary sometimes. Mm-hmm. Back at the Sawyer house. Cully bursts in on Bonnie and Crockett in bed. Cully puts the scare into Crockett before letting him run out into the night in his red satin boxers, which like Fred Willard in red satin boxers. That's something you want to poster up.
He's like, oh no.
We were just going over some files.
Yeah.
Well, and isn't it, and this is one that, so between watching three versions of the movie and reading the book in like 1 month, some of the elements that vary get convoluted in my head.
Me too.
But in this version, is this one of the versions where she tries to say that he was raping her?
I think she's like, oh, shoot.
I think he was forcing himself on me.
I think she said he was trying to take advantage of her.
Yeah, yeah. And we're like, bullshit.
So
Crockett runs off into the night right into a dark shadow with a taloned hand. And now we're back at the lake. Ben and Susan are smooching at the lake again. It's their smooching spot. But they're interrupted by the sound of a car.
It's the only place they can get away from that broad's binoculars next to the lake.
That's right.
Behind a tree.
on my sweater. So, you know, they go to investigate the sound of the car, and Ben finds the car parked behind his Jeep. So he's like, oh, no, I can't leave. But Crockett is in the front seat of the car, dead. At the Glick house, Danny is awakened from a fitful sleep by the figure of his brother floating outside his bedroom window, scratching at the glass. Despite Ralphie's obvious fangs and glowing eyes, Danny opens the window and lets him in, and Ralphie enters in a swirl of mist.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's under kind of some kind of like little spell.
Spell, yeah. So. Their eyes are supposed to be hypnotic.
Otherworldly.
And this is interesting that rather than when they were filming this, Toby Hooper made the call rather than to use wires to do these floating window scenes, he had them on like a boom. And it was to save money, but then it turned out like he realized when they then had to have them like floating into the room, they wouldn't have been able to do it with wires anyway, so it turned out working better.
Well,
there you go.
This is the magic of movie making.
Yes, you try to save money and it actually works out to your advantage. Okay, so Ben and Susan make a report to the constable as Crockett's body is taken away from the car, and then Ben takes Susan home. Dr. Norton, Susan's dad, says that Danny Glick has collapsed and no one can figure out what's wrong with him. So the reunion with his brother did not work out well for him. The next day, Mike finds his dog's body, very sad, while a search party is combing the woods for Ralphie. Ben, who is helping with the search party, finds a piece of black fabric on a bush and says to the constable that Straker always wears a black suit. So the constable visits a gray-suited Straker at the antique shop and questions him. And Straker is like, well, both my black suits are at the cleaners. Mm-hmm. But he agrees to bring them to the station the next day for the constable to examine.
He's like, podunk, constable.
Yeah. I'll certainly bring my suits to you, but please don't keep them. I need them.
I need many black silken fabrics and leather-bound books. Rich. Sorry. It just seemed very, like, Ron Burgundy. Yeah. Like, I kept feeling like he was emanating that.
Yeah. And that's why I feel like this actor was so perfect for this role, because he just has that, like, condescending European tone. It's just kind of like ick.
Yeah, he just sounds like a jackass all the time.
Yeah, pretty much.
Even if he's, well, yeah, he just seemed like threatening always, even if it's just like, I will go get a glass of water.
Or I'd be like, okay. Ah!
From
Let
where?
Me see your hands.
Okay.
Okay, so Dr. Norton argues with Ben over the evil nature of the happenings. He's like, Crockett died of a heart attack, but Dr. Norton admits he's unsure what's going on with the Glick boys. Danny possibly has pernicious anemia, which, even though it is a legitimate medical condition, it doesn't make sense for a healthy young boy to just have it out of nowhere.
Yeah, he was like, oh, they should have about 80-something percent. And,
and he's
got like
40.
He's not able to make new red blood cells.
And yeah.
Just leaking out of them.
Nothing weird happening.
What's
here?
What's happening?
Yeah. But luckily, Danny's hospital window is the same huge, fully opening style of window that he had at home. So when Ralphie returns to his hospital room scratching at the glass, Danny can let him in again to feed. And then the next morning, a nurse finds Danny dead in his hospital bed.
Yeah.
It was very sad. Bros aren't supposed to do that to bros. Bros before hoes.
Well, bros are vampires. Vampire.
Yeah. Okay, so Straker snottily brings his black suits to the constable.
Here you go, you dipshit.
Have them back to me post-haste.
Post-haste. My God. Ugh.
And then at the soda shop, Susan tells Ben that she got an interview for a job in Boston, so she won't be there for Danny Glick's funeral the next day. Because, of course, this is a small enough town where there's a funeral that everybody goes.
Everyone will go, and it'll be noticed that she's gone, so right. She has to have, like...
This is why.
This is a reason why.
Yeah. So after everyone is gone from the graveside service following the funeral, Mike, who is our cemetery worker, starts to fill in the hole in a gathering storm until, seemingly in a trance, he just jumps into the grave. He, you know, brushes all the dirt aside. He opens the coffin, and Danny pops up, all fangs and glowing eyes, and sinks his teeth into Mike's neck.
Well, the way he was leaning forward, it felt like when you let your intrusive thoughts, like,
what if I just jumped into the grave?
What if I just fell right into this grave? Yeah. It looked like that was kind of happening, because he's like, fell in there.
So, now Ben meets with Mr. Burke for dinner again, but they're interrupted when a pale and woozy Mike stumbles into the restaurant and to their table. Mike tells an incoherent story, and there are puncture wounds on his neck. So they are understandably concerned, and Mike agrees to stay the night at Mr. Burke's house and see the doctor in the morning. That night, Mark, our young Mark Petrie, our little school student that we've seen.
He reminds me of Charlie Bucket a little bit. A
little bit, yeah.
Like that big mess of blonde hair that's kind of like... Very 70s, 1970s.
Yeah, the Mark Petrie character, I have some thoughts about that. This iteration of Mark wakes up to vampire Danny Glick outside his window. But being the monster enthusiast that Mark is, he knows better than to let Danny in. So instead, he wields a crucifix at Danny through the window and sends him away. Mm-hmm. Okay, at 4 a.m., Ben gets a call from Mr. Burke, and before heading to his house, Ben asks Miss Miller to borrow a crucifix. Now, Mr. Burke and Ben investigate the sleeping Mike, who is, in the spare bedroom at Mr. Burke's house, and they find no pulse and also no marks on his neck, even though they were clearly there before.
I mean, he looks a lot better than he did.
Yeah.
And he just happens to be dead.
Right. Like, oh. He just happens to have no pulse and not breathing.
You're like, this looks good better. Oh, but except for that part.
Yeah. That's a downside. Mm-hmm. Mr. Burke points out that the open window he was sure was closed and locked the night before. He also tells Ben that he heard Mike invite someone into the room in the night, and he also heard terrible laughter. Ben convinces Mr. Burke to stay quiet about his vampire suspicions and just call the authorities, and soon Mike's body is taken away by the coroner. Mr. Burke, though, decides to fill Dr. Norton in on everything in hopes of getting help. He's like, you know, if we could get a doctor on our side, then that's a lot of credibility. And B, a doctor is going to look at the science of these deaths and these bodies and everything and recognize that this is not normal stuff.
Right. Something's
afoot. So Ben then visits the grand opening of the antique store, and he brings his evil house theory to Mr. Straker, who offers to give Ben a tour once Mr. Barlow arrives. We're like, oh, that doesn't sound suspicious at all.
You may come, and we will never speak to anyone else again. You'll just disappear from the face of the earth.
And nobody will care. Back in his boarding house room, Ben is ambushed and beat up by a jealous Ned. Remember Susan's ex-boyfriend?
Oh, Ned. I forgot. They changed his name, I guess, because it's Floyd Tibbetts
in
the book and in all the other remakes. It's except Ned. For...
Oh, one. Yeah. It's Floyd and all this. It's one of those words like, why?
What
why that
point?
One character?
Floyd's not going to confuse anybody.
No.
Okay. Whatever.
And they keep the last name the same, but not the first.
Yep.
So Ben lands in the hospital from this beating. Next, while studying up on vampires, Mr. Burke gets a visit from Mike, who is already inside the house. And that makes sense, right? Because Mr. Burke invited him in previously.
Right.
And so now Mike is able to just enter the house.
Just come in whenever he feels like it.
Yeah. But armed with a crucifix, Mr. Burke drives him out through a window. You know, I revoke my invitation. Get the fuck out of here. But then Mr. Burke suffers a heart attack.
Yeah.
Very sad.
He was a little bit scared.
Yeah, I would be too. But also very brave.
Yeah.
And masculine.
Well, he's a high school teacher. He's got to be brave.
Yeah. He suffers no fools. Okay, over in his jail cell, Ned wakes up to a shadowy visitor himself, and we get our first actual glimpse of our vampire, Mr. Barlow, who attacks Ned. So this is the first time that we actually see his the face of that character.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks like a vampire. He looks like Nosferatu.
Yeah.
Like, they definitely went very classic styling the appearance
He looks just like him.
Yeah.
Even down to the bald head.
Yeah,
the pointy ears.
Yeah, but, and like the features, like the cheekbones, the, you know, the face shape and everything. It's just, it's perfect Nosferatu. Now, at the Glick house, Danny's mother has fainted again, like she did at the funeral. And she says that she's been dreaming of Danny.
Uh-oh.
Later, while Ben is checking out of the hospital from his beatdown, Susan shows up and she reports that Ned has died of pernicious anemia, which just totally strikes when you're in a holding cell
it's not something that's contagious, correct?
It's not contagious, and it doesn't just happen.
Just crop up.
It has to develop over time.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's like saying you're like, I have a slight case of
cancer.
It'll go away. I don't know. It's just something that's like, it's
or like I hugged him and I got his cancer. Like, no.
No, that's not how that works.
That's not how that works. So Susan reports that Ned is dead and that Mrs. Glick is now dead too. But fortunately, Mr. Burke is stable in the hospital after his heart attack. So at least he's still alive.
Yeah.
After visiting his unconscious friend, Mr. Burke, Ben sets out to destroy the evil. First stop, of course, as it always is the local Catholic priest. Everybody hates the pedophiles until they have a vampire or they need an exorcism.
I need some holy water, please.
Yes, please. Please and thank you. So they go to see Father Callahan. And then the next stop is Dr. Norton, who shares the information that bodies have disappeared from the morgue, which, you know.
That's normal.
That's totally normal.
He's like, unless they just walked out of here.
You know what I'm saying, right?
And you're like, that's exactly what they did.
Yeah, that's a common thing that happens after sudden pernicious anemia.
Mm-hmm.
Next, Father Callahan visits the Petries about Danny's visit to Mark. Okay. And so this is a scene that appears in all three film versions. Yes. There's some variations. Some are better than others. But I think it's probably the strongest scene of this original movie.
Yeah. Because it didn't take much to convince the father that they needed some kind of help of some kind.
Yeah.
And he's like, coming for me. I'm like... He's not really a pillar. I mean, he's a pillar of the community, but also everyone knows what he's doing all the time, which is drinking heavily.
Oh, the priest?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then also with him comes some kind of respect or like understanding him as at least giving him like you're listening at least a little bit. Like I'll do the service of listening to what you have to say.
Yeah, because that's a big part of being a priest.
Right. Yeah. So it was great in all of the different versions.
Yeah. And they do like the beauty that you get in the novel is you know, obviously deeper understanding of Callahan's character and his experience and his faith and his views on the church and the changing role of the church and the changing attitudes. Like he talks about like new priests and their ideas or whatever.
Yeah.
But naturally any just average person would think that if you have a supernatural story, then you go to a man of God because that's someone that you presume believes in the supernatural. Like if you're like guaranteed the priest believes in Jesus and miracles and consecration. And so that's somebody who is not going to be like, well, vampires can't exist because science.
Right.
You know?
I mean, if anything taught me about belief in and capturing supernatural and things that are like miracles, it was going to the Vatican and seeing all of the art and all the stuff of that captured in throughout the centuries of, you know, bread turning into, you know, water into wine and all the loaves, and you see all this stuff and it's depicted in art and stories and all this stuff. So it's like, it wouldn't be a huge leap to be like, hey, something weird's happening.
Yeah.
Can you please listen to my story?
And this is somebody where, like I said, like that's a big part of a parish priest's job is to listen to your congregation. Like you're part therapist, part, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But then also the presumption that this is a man who believes in things beyond our world.
What we can see.
Yeah, beyond what science can prove.
Mm-hmm.
So this scene where Father Callahan goes, you know, with Mark to talk to his parents. And in the book, we know it's because Barlow has directly threatened Mark's parents. They don't bother to put that in any of the film versions. But in all film versions, Father Callahan goes with Mark to talk to his parents.
Right.
Yeah. And so they're all sitting around the table in the kitchen, and suddenly the lights go out. The house shakes violently. Objects start to move on their own. And then a cloak that bursts through the window, but it's just like a piece of fabric that lands on the floor, rises to reveal the vampire Barlow, who then, and this is kind of unfortunate, knocks Mr. and Mrs. Petrie's heads together like they were on the Three Stooges.
Yeah, he doesn't give a fuck. He's right. Like, bam, you're dead.
Yep. And that is how he kills them in the book, by smashing their heads together. But in this scene, in this movie, it had a real like, nyah, 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 like, you know, campy feeling.
Yeah,
and then he like pokes Mark in the eye with his two fingers.
I know. You're like, okay, well,
yeah, it's just kind of bonk, and they're both on the floor. But that somehow manages to kill them both.
Yeah.
You know, because in the description in the book, you like imagine the immense strength of this supernatural creature coming in, and that he just crushes their skulls without even an effort, right? But in the movie, it's just very much like bonk, like Wile E. Coyote.
A little bit silly.
Yeah. Which is unfortunate. But again, this is this is our second time laying eyes on the vampire, and we see him in, you know, his full figure, not just, you know, his face like in the previous time. And so it's a significant scene for that revelation, if nothing else.
He's a big, imposing figure.
Yes. Very scary. So Mark runs at Barlow, but he ends up, of course, in his clutches, while Father Callahan keeps his crucifix raised. Straker appears in the doorway of the kitchen, And I love it. He orders back, holy man, back, shaman,
back, shaman,
shaman. And that's a word that, like, it's in the book, it's in the other movie videos, like them calling the priest shaman. So it's like, I guess, supposed to herald to the fact that the vampire is such an ancient creature that it predates, like, the role of priest. Like, I've encountered holy people of all cultures in my thousands of years on your world. Whatever.
Yeah, and what are you? You're just another iteration of a shaman.
Exactly. And so Straker convinces Father Callahan to trade himself for Mark. And before running out of the room free, Mark swears vengeance on Barlow for killing his parents. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of interesting because I believe Barlow never speaks in this scene. I can't remember. No, just in this scene. Oh. Because Straker comes in and he's the one dialoguing with Father Callahan, which is not the case in the other forms. And no. I can't remember. This is one of those that it's like, it's so muddled between all the versions in my head.
In the Rob Lowe one, he speaks.
Yeah, but in the Rob Lowe one, he's not a he's just a dude. Like, he doesn't even look like a vampire.
Right. He looks...
normal human.
Like a normal guy. And yeah. He has like a full head of hair. And he's talking. He's like, eh, you guys are stupid.
Yeah. And in the newest one... He speaks. He looks like Nosferatu, but he does speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's one that there's little variations. Okay. At the funeral home, Ben is making a crucifix out of tongue depressors, as one does in this moment of urgency. And he's trying to remember Psalm 23 to try and bless this, MacGyver cross, when the body of Mrs. Glick resurrects on the slab. Mm-hmm. She attacks, but Ben burns a cross into her forehead with the crucifix that he's made, and screaming, she just vanishes. She just does a poof, and she's gone. In the car afterward, Ben relays guidance that he got from his occult friend in San Francisco. I love that part. He's like, I called a friend in San Francisco because...
Those are all the Satanists live.
Right?
Anton LaVey is there. I'm not wrong. That's where he had his house, right?
100%. So Ben says that he's learned that they need to destroy Barlow in his coffin during the day with a stake through the heart. Back at the Norton house, Ben tries to convince Susan to leave town. He's like, just go to Boston. You've got this interview. Just get out of town. Just leave and don't come back. Like, he just wants her to be safe. Okay. People all around town are fatigued from being fed on in the night. So, you know, a handful of people have been turned into vampires, but a lot of people in town are just being fed on.
Yeah. Everyone's like, I just feel tired.
Yeah. I feel like I caught pernicious anemia from Mike Ryerson.
Does she hate that?
Yeah, I do. But it's like, you know, the few active vampires have like hypnotically gained access and entrance into these houses so that they're able to just come back night after night. And these people just think, like, I've been having weird dreams and I'm so tired. And like some of them are like, oh, the sun, like, I don't like the sun. It bothers me. I'm just going to go back to bed. But they haven't been turned, it seems.
Yeah, they're just having reactions to being exposed to this virus or whatever it is.
Yeah. And of course, ignoring Ben's advice, Susan just drives out to the Marsden house. She's like, how about I do the opposite of get out of town?
You know what?
And go straight to the belly of the beast.
Is silly.
You're silly.
And I'm going to go prove you wrong.
You just think that because I'm a girl.
Women's live. No.
Feminism. So she drives out to the Marsden house just in time to see Mark arrive with several wooden stakes.
He's like, I don't give a fuck.
I do not. I'm a kid. I'll do whatever the fuck I want.
I'm doing this and you're not going to stop me.
Yeah, my parents are dead. There's nobody to tell me to stop. So Mark picks the lock on the cellar doors and goes in, and Susan follows him. She finds Mark upstairs, but before she can convince him to leave, he's rendered unconscious by Straker. Mark wakes up and he's tied to a chair, and Straker says that he took Susan to meet Barlow. Mm-hmm. So probably a bad call on both
Young
their
master.
Parts to just show up.
Young master. I took Susan.
To meet he who she came to call upon forthwith, etc.
Post-haste.
Post-haste. Okay, so then Ben finds the constable skipping town, which is hilarious because that happens in every version.
Bye, jabronis. I'm out of here.
Yeah, sheriff, constable, whatever you call him, he's always a little bitch and he runs off.
Goodbye. Good day. I said good day.
Goodbye. I said good day. He donates his gun to the cause. He gives it to Ben before he leaves. Next, Ben goes to the hospital and he hears from Dr. Norton that Susan is missing. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, it's not good. Mm-hmm.
So Ben swings by the Catholic church to get some holy water. Then he and the doctor go to the Marsden house. So now it's Ben and Dr. Norton. As they approach the front door of the house, Mark bursts out, having untied himself. And Ben tells him to run away. He's like, get out of here, kid.
They have your broad. Your broad's in there.
Does he tell them that Susan's in there in that moment?
I don't remember either.
Ben and the doctor. Oh, because also this is the only one where the doctor is Susan's dad. That's true. Not the case in the book or either of the other movies.
Right.
It's Dr. Cody.
Yeah.
And he's not related to anybody.
No, he's just the town doctor.
Right. Or she in the newest one. They made it female.
I loved her, though. She's like, what in the hell?
She's like, what is this bullshit?
I know.
Okay, so Ben and the doctor enter the house, and Ben is all triggered by his childhood memory, so he's kind of a mess. The doctor heads upstairs, and Ben is startled to see that Mark has come back inside the house, too. So now all three of them are in there. Upstairs, the doctor meets Straker, who picks him up and impales him on a wall of antlers.
Ugh.
What a bummer.
Bullshit.
Total bullshit. Which is interesting because in all of the other ones, remember, his character, the Dr. Cody character, dies by falling onto the knives in the cellar in the boarding house.
Yeah.
And, like, so in this one, it's kind of like the way they kill him is kind of similar in that being, like, impaled by a bunch of
Toby Hooper was like, I want to recreate the hook where Leatherface
puts
her up on a hook. Yeah. But this time it'll be antlers.
Yeah, so maybe that was a Toby Hooper brainchild. I could
maybe
see that.
Because
it's one of the few, like, violent, like, you know, like you mentioned, there's not a lot of gore in this. There couldn't be. It was for network television, but that also wasn't really Toby Hooper's thing.
Yeah.
And so this killing of Dr. Norton is one of the few times in the movie where you are like, what the hell? Because everything else is most of the other attacks are off camera, unless it's bonk, heads together. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's it for the doctor. So now it's just Ben and Mark. Heading down the stairs to where Ben and Mark are, Straker is shot repeatedly by Ben with the constable's gun, but it seems he's immune to all of the gunshots, but finally he collapses. Mark leads Ben to the cellar, where they find a door to the root cellar inside the main basement. When Butterfingers Ben drops the bottle of holy water before breaking the lock on the root cellar door. Inside, they find a casket and bodies. So, like, all of these, the other people that have been turned, that now that it's daytime, they've all come back to this place to sleep until the sun goes down again.
But they're not, like, smart. They're just like,
yeah.
They remind me a little bit of the Infected in 28 Days Later, where they're just kind of like sleeping in a pile.
And that's something that I thought we could like talk about later too, is the representation of the vampires, like what their behavior was like and also the numbers of them in the various movies of this, because that's something else that's different. So Ben drags the casket out of the root cellar into the main cellar, but just then he notices that the sun is set. Ben opens the coffin to reveal Barlow, who's sleeping in there, obviously, but he immediately awakens, hissing. He struggles as Ben drives a stake into him and Mark watches from nearby. So Barlow is slain.
Yes.
But over Mark's shoulder, we see the bodies from the root cellar slowly start crawling toward them. So this is another kind of like, it was a zombie feeling moment.
Yes.
And it was pretty creepy because Mark is watching, you know, Ben attack Barlow. And so he's facing away from the cellar, but we see over his shoulder this threat coming up behind him all slowly. So it was a pretty creepy moment. Yeah.
Coming to like,
But fortunately, Mark slams the root cellar door shut while Ben is driving the stake deeper into Barlow with a hammer. And then Barlow's face kind of time-lapse decays into a bear skull. And then Ben suddenly remembers, Susan! Oh my God, Susan! But I said, there's nothing for it. And Ben sets fire to the house before they drive away. Because he doesn't know what's happened to Susan. He doesn't know where exactly she is.
Yeah.
But it's like, he can't stay and look for her. He can't, you know, whatever. He's like,
we gotta get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. So he just torches the house and they get out of there. Ben stops the car. and Mark points out that the fire will blow toward town and all of Salem's Lot will burn. And I was like, Ben's like, yeah, it'll drive the rest of them out of hiding and purify the town. But then Mark asks all of them, and Ben says no, that the remaining ones will be hunting for them, for Ben and Mark.
Mm-hmm.
So then that brings us full circle back to Guatemala. Ben and Mark head out of the church that they were in at the very beginning. And in a nearby adobe, Ben finds a sexy sleeping broad. It's Susan. Somehow mm-hmm. Susan has gotten all the way to Guatemala. She coaxes him to join her in the immortal life. But instead of a smooch, she gets a stake in the heart because Ben is not about that vampire life.
Yeah.
And then the two fellas head out, presumably to continue their life of vampire hunting across the world.
Yeah.
And that is the end of the miniseries Salem's Lot.
Okay.
Meredith, your thoughts?
Not scary.
Nope.
At all.
Nope.
Fun story, though.
Mm-hmm.
I like the story.
Well, because you're a vampire fan. Do you think you like this representation of vampires?
Well, I like, a lot of people like the more romantic
mm-hmm.
representation, but I think it's fun, you know, where they're a grotesque monsters,
mm-hmm.
you know, that can't be really reasoned with. And to them, a person is just food
right.
or something to dominate. Mm-hmm. So I think that's... I think that's really fun and creates a whole different kind of monster and rather than I want to be part of it as a human.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not a Twilight situation.
No.
Or even like Mina in,
Bram Stoker's.
Bram Stoker's yeah. Dracula, where she's like entranced by him and mm-hmm. loves him.
Right.
You know, but there's no love between... Yeah. Barlow and any female character, which I'm fine without. Like, yeah. It doesn't need that. It's just you have this servant, Straker, that we all hate.
Mm-hmm.
And we can all kind of root for the heroes to hopefully get the hell out of there or try to save their town. And unfortunately, it didn't work.
No.
But I loved the opening of the book where it's like just talks about how kind of insidious it could be, where it can kind of... A small town could just kind of be infested without anyone really realizing it
mm-hmm.
and what would happen if that happened.
Yeah.
So I thought it was really fun. Just like people are getting sick. They don't know why. And it's suddenly it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed kind of viral in a way.
Yeah.
You know, where stuff is spreading and people are getting sick and dying.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes people don't really notice until it's too late.
Yeah.
So I love that aspect also.
Mm-hmm.
But. Yeah, I don't know. Did you think it was even remotely scary?
No, of course not. I will say that I liked this, like you say, this representation of the vampire. I feel like it's kind of, you're right that it's not a full-on romantic version of the vampire, the like refined gentleman vampire, like, you know, that at the Interview with the Vampire end of the spectrum, and then kind of Bram Stoker's, like the Gary Oldman Dracula. Like,
yeah.
He wasn't as sexy as Brad Pitt, but definitely had that refinement
mm-hmm.
element to the character.
Yeah.
And then for me, the other end of the spectrum will always be 30 Days of Night, where
yeah.
they're just monsters.
They're like land sharks.
Yeah. They just happen to drink blood.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really like the only thing that makes them vampirific at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything about them is more monster, zombie, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so I feel like this actually kind of falls somewhere in the middle because it has the element of the familiar, the refinement, and then particularly because what I pointed out with the scene at Mark's house with Father Callahan, in both this miniseries and in the most recent film, that Barlow has that Nosferatu appearance.
Right.
I really thought they did a beautiful job with him in the most recent one. Like, his face was really upsetting.
Yeah, like, he's, like, all covered in veins and stuff. When
yeah.
he was feeding, it was disgusting.
And he looked like, and I think we had talked about, I feel like we've talked about this for something else recently, but, like, the character from the It remake, the flute-playing lady.
Yeah.
Because you were telling, what movie were we talking about? Were you saying the actor that played that flute lady is also, like, the monster in a bunch of other stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if this was the same person.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's possible. It's appearing in a lot of that. Stuff. But yeah, just the way the feature, like the eyes are close, kind of close together. Mm-hmm. The cheekbones are really like hot, big and pronounced, like you've had cheek implants or something.
Oh, I remember now. It was Mama, and yes. The Mama was also the flute lady.
Yes,
and also
that's what it was.
Also the, shoot, what was it? The creature that was all sick and was like here and had all the bandages and
stuff. Oh, the leper.
Yeah, the leper also. Yeah. And is in a lot of other films being a scary creature of some kind.
Right. So that characterization of Barlow is more in line with the original one, even though evidently the makeup that they used in this film to make the Barlow character, like they must not have had, I mean, it wasn't so long ago that they didn't have good makeup materials, but evidently, mm-hmm. like, they were constantly having to stop and, like, patch and repair and re-glue. Like, they were using, like, plaster, clay, whatever bullshit they used to make Barlow in this film version. Mm-hmm. Was a real pain in the ass.
Yeah.
But there was those two, like they were pretty compatible. Mm-hmm. But then in the 2004 miniseries with Rob Lowe, they never show him as a vampire. They only show him as a human. Yeah. And so he is no different than any of the other vampire characters. He's just a regular looking human who has long fangs when he's showing his vampire business.
Yeah. And he just happened to be Barlow. Hey, I'm Barlow.
Yep. I'm the Barlow. Yeah.
I'm going to rip your head off.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Straker is Donald Sutherland, which was amazing.
I love Donald Sutherland, but in that movie, I was like, you're annoying to me.
But yeah, so I think that the idea of whether or not the vampire is like refined or like soulless, you know, like graceless, just animalistic, you know, that's obviously something that varies from one vampire story to another. Mm-hmm. But I, you know, I'm always thinking about like my attitude toward vampire stories and what is the deal? Why do they not resonate with me? Why don't I not naturally gravitate toward them or enjoy them very much? Mm-hmm. With, you know, cause obviously there are some exceptions. And I think the thing that this story that Salem's Lot brought out, for something that I'm like, oh, vampires, is that the things that can supposedly defeat a vampire are so silly and pathetic.
Like, oh, yeah.
How could a vampire possibly survive across the eons when he is so easily defeated by something in the shape of a cross? Mm-hmm. Like, all it takes is two tongue depressors taped together and blessed by somebody with no religious training to drive back a vampire. Like, a creature that is that vulnerable, that's just stupid, right?
Well, but Barlow was not.
No, but he also just laid there and let them drive a stake into him in all of, except the most recent one. That's the only one where he, like, fought back when they finally found his body in the coffin.
Yeah, he's a pain in the ass.
Yeah, and the other two, he literally didn't even bother to sit up.
Yeah.
He just laid there while they drove a stake through his heart.
Yes, because you're vulnerable during the day.
But it was nighttime. Yeah, it had just fallen night both of those times. And so it's like, you know, especially because in the Rob Lowe one, like they talk. Like he's like talking to Ben's character. Mm-hmm. And like, I guess trying to like sway him or convince him or, you know, draw him over to his side or whatever. But it's like, if he's in that, I don't know. Like, it just seemed so ridiculous that this creature that is supposed to be beyond time, mm-hmm. because he is so evil and so indomitable, can so easily be like, it's like, oh, but there's garlic. Whoopsie.
Vanquished.
Exactly.
I've been vanquished.
Like, garlic is your weakness? Are you real? And so I think that's why some versions of vampire stories I'm on board with, mm-hmm. but these more classic traditional ones, I think I'm less beguiled by because of that idea that this is supposed to be this terrifying creature, like the stuff of nightmares. But if you have a cross, you're okay.
Yeah.
Like,
well, it's man, it's man's way of being, having a false sense of safety.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know.
So, yeah, I think that was the vampire kind of, not, wouldn't say epiphany, but idea that came to me in watching all of these various versions of the story. I think that another thing that I really loved, I would say, and that I think they did the best job of in the newest one that we mentioned before, is the Mark Petrie character.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's something that Stephen King does often and beautifully, is write children.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is a perfect example.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he must have such a fundamental, deep admiration for, like, the courage of children.
And the spirit of
and,
them.
Yeah. Yeah. And, like, you know, because it's kind of a natural thing to be like, well, children are gullible. They're willing to believe stuff adults won't. But he doesn't frame it like that. He frames, like, their willingness to believe is actually a strength. It's like a character strength rather mm-hmm. than a flaw or a weakness of childhood.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, there's always these situations where the adults are failing to face up and deal with the threat.
Yeah.
And so children step up. And Mark Petrie's character, like, I actually think this one in the original version is, well, it's tied for the weakest. I think the weakest was in the Rob Lowe one, because he was just kind of a little dick.
He
a
just
little
happened
bit.
To be there.
Like, yeah, he had kind of an attitude. They made him, it seemed like they made him a little older. Like,
yeah,
he was
a high schooler.
Yeah, instead of being,
although,
like,
in
11
the book
or 12.
He was, like, a high, like, yeah, older, right? Am I wrong?
No, he was 11 or 12 in all the other ones.
Okay.
But in this miniseries, I think he was in high school because he was rehearsing at the high school when Ben first went and saw Mr. Burke.
Okay.
Both those iterations were in high school, but in the newest one, he explicitly says that he's 11, almost 12.
Right,
and I'm pretty sure in the book he's like tween age as well. He's a little bit younger, because in the book they have the same scene that they did in the newest movie, where he confronts the school bully, and he's at an elementary school.
Yeah, yeah.
He's
like, say uncle.
Right? Yeah, 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 that thing. And so, you know, Mark's character, he in all of them, he's very, happens to be knowledgeable about the occult. That's just his curiosity or his interest. And so that invites him into the story for that reason. But he's also, like, he's brave. Mm-hmm. And that's why I loved that character in the newest one. Like, he might have mm-hmm. been my favorite. Like, he had no time for the bullshit. He was just like, what do we need to do? We need to take care of this. Like, I'm just going to go.
I swore vengeance. And so that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, I made my stakes. I'm going to go look for him. I don't mm-hmm. need a grown up with me. I don't fucking care. I'm just going to take care of this.
Yeah.
And in the book, he had that spirit, but because it's a book and not a movie, there was a lot more description of how that was a struggle for him, because he was still a little boy.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
In the book, it talks about the times that he was scared, or he didn't want to go into that building, or, you know, the times in the story when he cried, like, after his parents died, or, you know, things like that. Like, you saw a lot more vulnerability, and I wouldn't call it weakness, but, like, age appropriateness in the character in the book.
'Cause he's still a little kid.
Yeah, but yeah. In the book and in the newest one, I think you saw that thing that Stephen King does so well of making a kid the hero.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and especially in the newest movie, like, Ben would have, the vampires would have gotten Ben if it hadn't been for Mark, because he, you know, he drives the car and knocks down the big screen at the drive-in
mm-hmm.
and, you know, sheds light on the three vampires that Ben has somehow been able to hold off for, like, a solid
minute. To
keep
them from, like, biting him. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, he would have been toast mm-hmm. if it had, and it wasn't just that Mark was there, but that Mark was smart enough and capable enough to be like, I need to knock the sign down. I'm going to use this car. I'm going to go through here. And then he drives over Susan's mom and saves Ben a second time.
Yeah. He's like, he's the ultimate hero.
Yeah. Yeah. He's an amazing character.
I liked him. I don't know. I didn't get to finish the book. I'm like probably 2/3 of the way through it.
Mm-hmm.
But the part where Mark was channeling Houdini to get all those ropes, and it, like, describes in detail him mm-hmm. struggling and sweating and not getting too excited and have to calm down so he can, like, you know, keep on task and keep and, you know, do what he needs to do to get out of the situation.
Yeah.
And I'm like reading it like, ah! You know, like, I'm all tensed up myself, mm-hmm. like, listening to this whole scene of this little boy trying to get out of this, mm-hmm. and being more mature than an adult would be to get out of a really dicey situation.
Yeah.
So that was it was amazing. It was great. The high school one in the Rob Lowe one, yeah, I didn't he was just care about.
Like,
it.
Meh.
He was like a filler that no one really cared about.
Yeah. Yeah, you didn't admire his character. He didn't seem to be as vital. They did form the bond between, because that was a big element, the bond between Ben and Mark.
Yeah.
Because, and then obviously the two of them being the only survivors, and then, you know, having that kind of father-son connection.
Right,
That it was just, like, less genuine, I think. You didn't see the performers really capture that connection in the Rob Lowe one.
Mm-hmm.
I think you got it in this original, mm-hmm. and you definitely got it in the newest one.
Yeah.
And 100% in the book. Mm-hmm. But you didn't see them galvanized in the Rob Lowe one very well.
Yeah, that was missing for sure, that part. I also have to comment on what happens after you get turned into a vampire if you're Susan. Like, you have to be, except for the remake, like, or mm-hmm. the newest one.
Yeah.
You have to wear a blue or purple eyeshadow and have, like, crinkled hair.
Yeah, crimped hair.
Crimped hair. And that's what you look like. And you, I was, like, laughing. I was like,
well, you're,
oh.
You're his bride.
You naturally, you're turned into that immediately.
Yeah.
Because he, like, opened the coffin. She's, like, bright purple eyeshadow. And I was like, what? That was not
Is
what
this
she
Madonna?
Looked like when she came. She went to that house. She was wearing, like, a brown, you know, coat or something or whatever.
Yeah.
Business casual. She wasn't dressed like that.
Like, ew, who changed her clothes? I hope funny. She changed them.
If you would rank your favorites, which one would it be?
The newest one.
The newest one.
Which I know you've told me, because I don't read reviews, that a lot of people shit on the new one.
Yeah, even especially, like, Tony.
Yeah.
He had big problems with it. Yeah. He's like, I thought it was shit. I didn't like it. And I'm like, I think maybe the nostalgia you had for the original.
Yeah. If you had really strong feelings for the original, I could see.
You probably wouldn't like the changes that they made.
Because they did. They made a lot of changes to the story.
Yeah, they did. There's no movie drive-in theater in the remake. Mm-mm. But I love the teacher, the guy who plays the teacher in the remake.
Homicide, yeah.
He's great. He's in it's the miniseries The Night Of, mm-hmm. and he's fantastic in that. And then he's great in this one, too. And I love even the actor who played Mike. He was in Unbreakable. He was the little boy who was in the new version with Bruce Willis, mm-hmm. as well as an adult. Helping his dad with his Unbreakable character, him being this hero.
Oh, yeah. The guy that played, Mike Ryerson's character. How Spencer Treat. Spencer something Treat.
I don't recall. But I liked
that's
him
his name, because he's been on
too,
a, I know you're not an SVU person, but he was on SVU a lot. And he's, he was a prolific child actor. We're using the word prolific way too much.
Prolific.
But he was a major child actor. He worked a lot when as a kid. And he's actually, like you say, managed to still have roles and be working now that he's not like because he was an adorable little kid. He's a really good looking guy.
He's a handsome fellow. Yeah. He's like in his mid-20s or maybe a little older.
I think he's probably, probably older at this
maybe
point.
Maybe early 30s.
Looks good.
He's great. And I liked Susan in the newest version was fine.
Mm-hmm.
She's all right.
Susan wasn't the strongest in any of them.
No.
Bonnie Bedelia might have been the best Susan.
Yeah.
Because I love... Miranda Priestley. Wait, no, that was her character that was her character in A Thing Called Love. Who plays Susan in the Rob Lowe one?
Oh, I know who you're
What's
talking
her
about.
Name? I'm totally remember. Blanking.
This is called the I Can't Remember Her Name podcast.
Yeah, she was in one of the Little Women versions. Yes. She was,
She was a major actor, and I randomly brought this up to Victor because I was watching the remake, and I was like, I love her. She was in The Strain.
I don't think I know that one.
It's a vampire show that you'd probably... It's actually kind
of... probably hate it.
No. Because it's Benicio del Toro did it.
Mm-hmm.
And these creatures were very similar to the creatures in this, like, iteration of vampires. They're, like, kind of ghouls.
Yeah.
Essentially. And she plays the Staten Island mayor, who's like, all of Manhattan's getting infested.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, it was very like this, like mm-hmm. in Salem's Lot, where people are like, people are feeling weird. They're like calling out to work. What's going on? And it was like a virus spreading.
Okay.
But she also was in all this stuff and a huge actress. And then her boyfriend or fiance, whatever, River Phoenix, died.
Mm-hmm.
And then she went through like a severe depression over that loss and kind of had to step away.
Yeah.
And she opened up after 20 something years and wrote or had somebody interview her about it, just going through that.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting because I was like, what happened to her? I saw her in so much stuff and then she was gone.
Yeah.
So I thought, I was like, she was really great in that one too. She mm-hmm. was kind of fun. I liked it when the teacher, Mark? No, that's wrong.
The teacher was Matt.
Matt. He's walking up the stairs and she's like, anyway.
Like, he's like, keep talking.
Yeah. And that's like, it happened just in the book, the exact same way, mm-hmm. where he's like, keep talking, pretend like we're still. And she's like, I don't even know.
You know, like, watching him go and just talking loudly.
So I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
In a really tense moment. And I feel like it was meant to be a little bit of like a
cheeky.
Yeah.
So Samantha Mathis.
Yes.
Is her name. And the reason, like, the name that came to my mind, Miranda Priestly. So in The Thing Called Love is the movie she made with River Phoenix where they got together.
Yeah. So sad.
Wherever we were. But I think that the other thing that varied a lot between everything and the book is how it began and how it ended.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, in the book, they, you know, they end by deliberately, you know, so the book starts where they're in Mexico, not Guatemala.
Yeah.
And then they're tracking the news accounts and everything. And like maybe a year has passed.
And Mark's trying to go into the priesthood or something. Join the church.
Yeah. Join the church. Mm-hmm. He wants to become a Catholic. And so, but then while watching, you know, the news stories and everything, then it goes back in time. It tells all of the events up to, and then it's the Mark and Ben go back like a year later, and it's been a very dry fall, and they go up to the Marston house and they set a fire. And in the book they talk a lot about the fire of 51. There was like this huge fire in Salem's Lot in the past,
right?
And
so
they're basically trying to recreate that to destroy the town.
Uh-huh.
And in the 2004 miniseries, they burn the house down. In this one, they burn the house down.
Mm-hmm.
Then in this original miniseries, it goes back to Guatemala and Susan's there, whereas Susan dies in Salem's Lot in all of the other iterations.
Right.
And then, but in the newest one, they don't set fire to the town. Do they?
I don't remember. I know they kill Susan at the drive-in.
Right, they kill Barlow at the drive-in as well. But I don't think that I don't think that it ended with them, like, destroying the town.
No.
Which is, mm-hmm. There's the follow-up short story that I mentioned that was in Night Shift, and it was called One for the Road. It was supposedly after the fire that Ben and Mark came back and set, I believe. But then there was a sequel movie, which I've never seen, that came out in 1987, The Return to Salem's Lot. Have you ever seen that one?
No, but it was on our friend's Plex. He's like, I put it on there. It looks like not good, but.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and evidently there's like none of the characters return.
Yeah.
There's no overlap with the stories whatsoever, mm-hmm. even though evidently in like the poster art that they used in their publicity, they had the image of Barlow from the first movie.
Right.
Even though it was not part of the sequel.
So what would you say is your favorite version? Or like, would you say like a mishmash of everything?
No, definitely the newest one is my favorite version, even though it's the least true to the book. And okay. I think the book is beautiful. I think that the representations of the characters in the newest one were the best and the most fun,
truer to the source material.
No, I don't necessarily think the newest one was truest to the book. Because like I said, I think maybe the Mark character was, the Ben character, yeah, maybe the Ben character too, because Rob Lowe never really read to me like the Ben in the book.
No, I don't think so either.
And it's because he's Rob Lowe. He's too Rob Lowe.
He's too cute.
He can't not be Rob Lowe, even at that point in his career. And
diabetes.
But I loved the Dr. Cody. I think that the Dr. Cody in the Rob Lowe one was the closest to the book, Dr. Yes, Cody.
I think so too.
But I loved the
I love Alfre Woodard.
Alfre Woodard, yeah. The riff on Dr. Cody's character for the newest one.
Yeah, she was fun. I think the
Matt in the newest one was great. I think the Matt in the Rob Lowe one was a good job too.
He was, yeah.
Like he had I don't know. Yeah, he was less like the Matt in the book. I think the Matt in the newest one was most like the Matt in the book for me.
I think I agree. Yeah.
But
I mean, I liked the new, I really liked it, even though they changed a bunch of things happening.
Yeah. And but you needed to condense it.
Yes. And, but also the part with her mom becoming like part of it.
Becoming the new familiar after Straker died.
We don't need to do that.
Yeah. That was kind of unnecessary.
Yeah. I have a question.
Sure.
Did you ever see Chapelwaite?
No.
It was based on the short story, Jerusalem's Lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the 1850s, and it takes place in that space. And it has Adrienne Brody as the main character. And she plays, I can't remember her name, but she plays Stevie from Schitt's Creek.
Oh, yeah?
And
so this is pretty recent, this Chapelwaite?
It came out in 2022, I want to say.
Yeah.
2021. It was really good.
Yeah.
It was good, but then it had only one season, and I liked it.
Yeah.
It was like they go to, like, he lives on a ship with his family and his three children and his wife. And his wife passes away, and they've just, like, lived a life on the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets a letter from his cousin Stephen that, or his estate, that his cousin Stephen has died, and he left his home, Chapelwaite, to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, children, we're gonna leave the sea, and we're gonna have a fresh start back in Maine. But he left for other reasons too, because there's some sort of inherited weirdness with the fathers and his family,
yeah,
like fucking going crazy,
okay,
like being killing their family,
right.
Anyway, so then he comes back, and I mean, I love Adrienne Brody, he's great.
Oh yeah.
And the setting is really nice. It's not nice, I'm just saying, like, beautiful house. It's in the 1800s. There's horse and carriage.
Is it set in Maine?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, check it out. I think you might like it.
Yeah, Jerusalem's Lot was, it's funny, it was, as a short story, was published in Night Shift, the same collection of short stories that had One for the Road in it,
okay.
But that was published after Salem's Lot was published as an individual novel.
Okay.
But it was, it's funny that it has all of this kind of classic vampire elements, the stake through the heart, the garlic, the blah, 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 because evidently Stephen King's inspiration for this was back as a child seeing the film Dracula for the first time.
Yeah.
Imagining, like,
in the prologue, right? Said something about the comics that he would read.
Yeah.
Like those gross comics where the vampires are grotesque, like gross creatures.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh yeah, I could see it in his writing too. That yeah.
But it's like, and I guess it struck him the idea of, well, what would happen if Dracula was in Maine?
Yeah.
Like, so it was just like you were talking about, like, taking this small town setting and what would happen if you introduced this quote unquote virus into this small town, this, like, kind of somewhat isolated. I mean, it's, you know, it had neighboring towns and everything, but in a manner, like, what happened in the lot stayed in the lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Well, I love this. I mean, the original miniseries
it's
is like
a little
whatever.
Bit of a dud, but you know,
I mean,
worth seeing once.
Yeah, I think it's fun. And so far, I mean, I'm like 2/3, maybe even further into the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I've really been enjoying it. And then all of the different iterations are fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, they all offer something different.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed the most recent one, even though people kind of weren't fans.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people who have big issues with sometimes just have too much love or nostalgia for mm-hmm. something, even if it's not that great.
Yeah. Well, and that's why, like, I feel like people resist or reject sequels or remakes just out of hand mm-hmm. because they don't have space in their heart or in their imagination for different takes on something.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, it's your favorite book in the world and they make it into a movie and you don't even see the movie, but you're already disgusted at the idea that they're making your favorite book in the world into a movie, and you watch it and you're like, well, that was nothing. Like, the book is so much better. Like, that kind of attitude. And it's like, it's a different medium. Every person that produces a film is an artist in and of themselves. And so they're going to bring something to it. They're not just there. Like, you aren't just a machine to make a printed book into a visual film. Like, they're bringing something else to it. And so that's why I get really excited for remakes and reboots, because, I mean, and sometimes they miss the mark.
Yeah.
And sometimes they blow it, but sometimes they come up with something, you know, a completely different perspective or of imagining or image of something that has been done previously. And there's space in the world for both, you know?
Yeah. I mean, what really comes to mind just now when you said that was Gerald's Game.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read it and then I found out they were doing a movie of it, I was like,
how?
Yeah. And they knocked it. It was knocked it out of the ballpark.
Because it was Mike Flanagan. I mean, he can do anything.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
But it's like, I loved the use of Gerald, that mm-hmm. actor. I loved it, how they used him throughout. Mm-hmm. And that was similar to the book. But then I also loved her just being herself, and she, two different versions of herself. Mm-hmm. And she's amazing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I don't know. I'm here for it. I don't care about the haters. So
yeah.
I'll watch everything.
I think another one, a good example is It, just because, like, especially mm-hmm. our age group, the original It miniseries was pretty seminal for a lot of us. Like, it came out right at that age when we were first realizing that this was something that we loved, and it was something that was age appropriate enough but terrifying, and so most of us have a deep and abiding affection for it.
Yeah, me especially.
Does that mean that you should like reject the remake? The remake was incredible.
Yeah.
And the remake was closer to the book than the original miniseries.
Because there's only so much you can show and
it reimagined Pennywise. It gave us another incredible Pennywise.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, Tim Curry has right in my heart, right next to Stephen King. And so, but I'm not going to be like, well, fuck Bill Skarsgård.
I'll reject anything that's different.
There's space in my heart for all of it.
all the creatives.
Yeah.
So, we'll just keep talking forever. So let's move on.
If you're still listening.
We are doing Cujo next time.
Yes, for our other September episode, continuing to check off some more Stephen King projects that are wonderful and worth discussing.
Yes, it was released the year of my birth, 1983.
Yeah.
Oh, fucking long time ago.
I was a little one-year-old baby.
Long time ago. But it has Dee Wallace, who's been in many horror mm-hmm. movies, and we love her. And
Danny Pintaro,
yeah.
If you're a Who's the Boss fan.
Little sweet baby angel.
Yeah.
So check it out.
Definitely check it out.
All right. Bye.
Bye.